Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Today, we have with us Todd Caponi, and we will speak with him about his latest book, The Transparency Sale.
We contracted with a local university, Northwestern University here in Chicago, to take a look at how consumers act and behave when they're buying something online. And so essentially when a website is acting as the salesperson. All right. So the research came back and the first piece was, you know, as it turns out, and this is no surprise, we all look at reviews now before we buy anything online that's of medium to high consideration that we haven't bought before. But the piece that changed my life, like literally I quit my job and wrote a book. 82% of us specifically skip past the 5-star reviews and go right to the negatives. We seek out the negatives first. And when a product has an average review score between a 4.2 and a 4.5, those products actually sell at a higher rate than any other score, which includes a 5. So a 4.2 sells better than a 5. So I looked at this and said, all right, this is when a website is acting as the salesperson. What happens in human-to-human B2B type sales? And I went on this journey to find out, and I uncovered this whole treasure trove of neuroscience research around how our brains are wired to make decisions, and realized that so much of that, most of it hasn't made its way into sales yet. And so I had this theory, tested it a few times, and it turns out when we lead with transparency and embrace our flaws early in a sales cycle, you know, realizing 82% want the negative first anyway, when we do it in human-to-human sales, magic happens.
Todd Caponi is the author of the award-winning book, The Transparency Sale. He's the managing director of Chicago's Venture Scale, a speaker and workshop leader as principal of Sales Mellon, LLC. Up until mid-2018, he had spent almost 4 years building the revenue capacity of Chicago's Power Reviews from the ground up as their chief revenue officer, turning it into Illinois' fastest growing tech company. Prior to that, he held sales leadership roles with 3 other tech companies, including ExactTarget, where he helped drive the organization to a successful IPO and a $2.7 billion exit through the acquisition by Salesforce.com. He's also a former American Business TV Award winner for VP of WW Sales of the Year. Now, on to this exciting episode with Todd Caponi.
Good morning, Todd. Welcome to Bits About Books.
Thanks for having me. I can't wait.
It's really wonderful because you have chosen a topic which is really close to my heart. And as we were speaking a bit earlier, I just shared with you some of the thoughts, but we'll keep that for later. Tell me, what compelled you to write this book?
Well, it's a strange story. My wife is still scratching her head over it, but I was the chief revenue officer of a company in Chicago, which is where I'm based, called Power Reviews. And what they do is they help retailers and brands collect and display ratings and reviews on their websites. And so my team was about 60 people. And when you think about what Power Reviews does, like think about when you buy something online, like, you know, if you're on buying a pair of Crocs or you're on Vineyard Vines or Jet and you're looking at a product and you look under it, and there's reviews. Power Reviews was the engine that helped those companies collect and display those. So here's what happened. We contracted with a local university, Northwestern University here in Chicago, to take a look at how consumers act and behave when they're buying something online. And so essentially when a website is acting as the salesperson, All right. So the research came back, and the second piece of this that I'm going to tell you about here in a second, when I got it, I read it and I immediately realized, wow, if this applies to the B2B world, it's a game changer. And so here was the research. The first piece was, you know, as it turns out, and this is no surprise, we all look at reviews now before we buy anything online that's of medium to high consideration that we haven't bought before. So, you know, they said that the data said 96% of us do, and I haven't found the 4% that don't yet. So I think we all do.
Right.
But the piece that changed my life, like literally I quit my job and wrote a book. 82% of us specifically skip past the 5-star reviews and go right to the negatives. Again, this is when a website's acting as a salesperson. So we seek out the negatives first. And when a product has an average review score between a 4.2 and a 4.5, those products actually sell at a higher rate than any other score, which includes a 5. So a 4.2 sells better than a 5. So I looked at this and said, all right, this is when a website is acting as the salesperson. What happens in human-to-human B2B type sales? And I went on this journey to find out, and I uncovered this whole treasure trove of neuroscience research around how our brains are wired to make decisions, and realized that so much of that, most of it hasn't made its way into sales yet. And so I had this theory, tested it a few times, and it turns out when we lead with transparency and embrace our flaws early in a sales cycle, you know, realizing 82% want the negative first anyway, when we do it in human-to-human sales, magic happens. You know, win rates went up, sales cycles shrank dramatically, we worked the deals we should be working, we lost the deals that we're going to lose anyway, but just faster, and we made it really hard on our competitors. I put together a book proposal. Had 3 publishers wanted to do it. I picked one. I ended up leaving my CRO job, and it was at the time considered the fastest growing tech company in Chicago, according to Deloitte.
Right.
And the rest is history.
Wonderful. So just to back up a bit, you had this data from this university you were working with, and that sort of triggered in you something which said that I need to make it my life's mission to spread this message.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it was this idea that I was sitting in my office reading it, and I looked to my right, and I had an office that had kind of like the glass windows, and I'm looking at my team and I'm thinking, wait a second. We've been teaching our sellers to sell as though we're perfect forever. You know, historically, you know, I'm in my, you know, mid to late 40s here. Right. And all the sales training I ever received was about, hey, like, don't tell them we don't do this, or don't tell them this doesn't work. We'll tell them about that later when they're really excited about us. Hmm. Or, you know, just basically hide the flaws. And so that's what really started it. But you combine that with this idea that today reviews and feedback have proliferated their way through everything we do, everything we buy, everything we experience. And, you know, that's true in the B2B space too. So the combination of the brain science tells us that leading with our flaws sells better than perfection. And then you match that up with the proliferation of reviews and feedback. It tells us that we should be doing it, but we need to do it anyway. We can't any longer hide our flaws and expect to get away with it. And so those two things together were what really started to fire me up around, you know what, there's a whole approach that you need to take, because you don't want to take it too far. You know, transparency does not necessarily mean, hey, Mr. or Mrs. Customer, this is why we suck. Like, that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
It's, you know, you got to embrace this 4.2 to 4.5 and lead with your flaws. And if your product's worse than that, you're probably not going to be around long in business anyway.
Exactly. So you had this data, which was, if I have understood it right, correlated with B2C purchases primarily.
Yeah.
And then you thought this should be applied to B2B.
Yeah, exactly. So I had this theory that, again, we've always taught our B2B sellers to sell as though we're a perfect 5.
Hmm.
Does positioning ourselves as a 4.2 and to 4.5 work better? And leading with our flaws, does that work better? And So we started trying it out. The first company that I tried it out with was a apparel manufacturer and retailer that most of you are familiar with, which is Calvin Klein up in New York. And so here's what happened. I was in New York. Again, I was the CRO. I had a VP of sales that reported to me. I'm in New York. I get a text from my VP of sales telling me, hey, we just had an inbound lead come in from Calvin Klein. So I called my VP of sales and I was like, oh, that's great. Tell me about it. And he's like, well, they're starting an evaluation for ratings and reviews technology. They're going to send out a request for proposal, an RFP. And then based on that, they're going to bring us up to New York to their headquarters to do a full presentation. And then it clicked with me. I was like, I'm in New York right now. I've got some time open, just a long shot, but could you reach out to this head of e-commerce for Calvin Klein and ask him if he's got an hour for coffee? I would love to meet him, you know, considering this lead is so fresh. Well, it turns out he says yes. Wow. So I go to their office. I walk in, the guy meets me at the, you know, his floor, takes me back to his office. Again, I'm under the impression we're having coffee. Well, he points me to his monitor by which I should plug in my laptop so I can do my presentation. And I look to my right and the room is filling up with people. And so I'm suddenly thrust into this thing where I thought I was having coffee, but their expectation was I was doing a full presentation. So instead of doing what they asked, which their head of e-commerce literally started the conversation in a very New York way, you know, in the best way possible. No small talk. It was just, hey, Todd, we're looking at your competitor. We're looking at you. How are you better? And so, you know, most salespeople would go into their pitch. I decided to try this whole concept and see what would happen. And instead I said, listen, you've got a bunch of people in here. You're investing a bunch of time in this evaluation. Can I start with one thing that our competitors are better than us at? They actually just released an add-on to their solution that we don't have. And if that's going to be important, let's talk about that now. Because if it is, and it's going to be an important decision criteria, we can save everybody a lot of time. You could feel the whole room disarm. The head of e-commerce was like, yeah, sure. So, you know, he went from New York to, hey, I trust you. Thank you. And so I literally pitched our competitor's add-on tool that we didn't have. And when I did that, everybody in the room looked at each other and they had a little conversation about it. And they're like, it's interesting, but it's not on our radar at all. It's got nothing to do with ratings and reviews. It's kind of this add-on thing. And so, okay, Todd, thank you. Let's talk about, you know, is there anything else? And if not, let's talk about what you guys do. And so I was like, all right. So I talked about what we did. So I went to the, you know, kind of the positives. Very quickly, the head of e-commerce stopped the meeting, looked at everybody and said, I've heard enough of you. And they're all like, yeah. And everybody's smiling. He kicks everybody out of his office, pulls out his budget and literally showed me his budget line item for our type of technology and asked me if we can hit it. What ended up happening is 2 weeks later, they called and told us that they've selected us. They threw out their whole RFP process and their whole formal presentation process over this one meeting that we had. And I was like, all right, I think we're on to something here. And so we kept trying it. And the results continued to be magic around leading with your flaws, embracing transparency, and starting a sales process with that strong foundation of trust, which most sellers are not armed to be able to do.
It's time for a short break. When we come back, we will hear Todd tell us about what he learned from Tyra Banks and what is Flossom. We will be right back. You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end. Welcome back. As we went into the break, Todd mentioned about a quote from Tyra Banks he came across. This is what he found.
This is a fascinating story, and I am really now intrigued how you took this one meeting into a process. So tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you just look across, so it became a couple of things. Number one is because there's a proliferation of reviews and feedback on everything, as a seller, we should be acting like a buyer and going out into the web and looking at review sites and figuring out, all right, if I'm a buyer, what am I going to find? Like, what are the negative things that I'm going to find when I look? And then, you know, working with your marketing team to craft that 4.2 to 4.5 messaging, right? To, you know, not go too far, but to make sure that you're leading with something that that buyer is going to find. And when that buyer does find it and finds that it matches with exactly what you said, their need to go do more homework goes down because there's now this match and this foundation of trust. So that's really where it started, is you've got to get an understanding of what your buyers are going to find and how your competitors are going to sell against you. You could bet anything that our competitor was going to sell Calvin Klein on their add-on, especially since their first beta customer was The Gap, you know, another apparel company. So you knew that was coming, so why not lead with it and get it out there? And now when our competitor would then go in and try to undercut us by throwing that add-on as a part of it, our buyers were already prepared for that, and we basically cut our competitors off at the knees. So, you know, that's kind of the starting process, is you've got to do your research and understand what they're going to find and what your competitors are going to say, and then work on your messaging from there that kind of embraces that transparency, leads with it. And it's actually a funny little sign item that I found after I wrote the book, is that, you know, the supermodel Tyra Banks, she coined the term flossom.
Right.
And flossom is to embrace your flaws, but know that you're still awesome. And I think that that's very appropriate for the future of B2B sales, is we're all flawed. No buyer expects or believes that we're going to be perfect. So embrace your flossomeness. Present yourself as a 4.2 to 4.5 and watch the magic happen.
Wonderful. So now let's move on to the book specifically. As you decided to write this book, how did you now go and structure the book, and how did you decide how the content is going to flow? And so let's start there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And given that I had never written a book before, I'd been, you know, in sales leadership with four different companies before coming to this conclusion, I needed a lot of help. But basically what happens is when you get an idea for a book and that you become passionate about it, everything you see feels like it can fit in. And so there was a whole process. I had to use some technology to help me capture all those thoughts. Like, I'm walking down the street, I see something, and I'm thinking, you know what? I got an idea. And so I pull out my phone and have to pop that in there somehow. So, you know, essentially what I did is I laid out a lot of these ideas, but I thought about it in terms of what buyers do on their buying journey. So if we talk about, you know, buyers want to seek out the negative first because they're wired to try to predict what their experience is going to be like, they go through a three-step process, which is they decide whether or not they need to change from what they're doing today. So why change? Once they do, they decide whether to do it with you or not. So why you? And then once they decide to do it with you, it's why now? Like, why should I do this now versus waiting 6 months, 12 months, 5 years?
Right.
And so I decided to look at the applications of transparency as it applies to how buyers go through their journey. So that the first section is essentially the kind of the background and the research and the philosophy and, what my joking word, the nerdery. But then we get very tactical into the book, into how do you apply it to your positioning, your prospecting. Then we get a little further, your presenting. And then I think the applications to negotiation are like life-changing. It's what I'm spending a lot of my time teaching companies today, is something called transparent negotiating, you know, at the goal line, instead of, you know, acting like we're in a Texas Hold'em poker tournament where we hide all of our flaws. Playing your cards face up has magical impacts on your deal values and the predictability of those deals. And then that last section is around kind of the random applications throughout post-sales, interviewing, your conference booth. There's a bunch of kind of random applications for how you can use transparency to make those things more effective as well.
if you are okay with it, I would like to like you to deep dive a bit section by section how you actually went about doing the research and how the first manuscript came about and who is it that you showed it to first. So, and what kind of stories were you able to now even retrospectively fit in to support the narrative?
Yeah, it's funny. When I decided to write the book, so I got this idea. I don't know if your listeners have ever heard of something called Masterclass, which is, yeah, so it's a place where you can go online and get like classes from the masters in different categories. And it was literally like the next day, I got an email, Masterclass promotional email about Malcolm Gladwell.
Okay.
And so I was like, this is perfect timing. So I took the Malcolm Gladwell class, and for me personally, it really opened my eyes to the process of writing a nonfiction book. There was a couple of things that really stood out. So first of all, if a book is only my stories, I think those are boring in terms of the kind of books I like to read. I don't want to read books that are just the author's stories. And so I knew there was two paths I can go. And Malcolm taught me this as a part of that class. You can either do it research-backed, or if you're going to tell stories, interview people.
Right.
And then there's potentially a combination of the two. And I decided to do the combination of the two. So, you know, my process, the first thing that he talked about, and it's funny, we have gotten so into Amazon that we've forgotten that there's these places right down the street called libraries that are filled with, you know, thousands of books that are filled with nuggets of incredible information that you can check out for free. Right. And so, so that was like, I went into the library with one book in mind. And one of the things Gladwell teaches is when you go and you find that book on the shelves, look to the left, look to the right, look up, look down, because they're typically categorized together. And so every library visit, I'm grabbing 5 to 10 books and sitting down and reading as much of these things as I can. And a lot of it was neuroscience. So the second piece to that was that I'm not a neuroscientist. So I would read some of these things and think I knew what they meant. And so here's a funny little side story. I did a search because I'm in Chicago, and I wanted to find a neuroscientist in Chicago that I could maybe just have, you know, buy lunch, have coffee with, and bounce some of these ideas off of that could help me dumb it down. And so I did a Google search. Apparently, there's a Neuroscience Institute of Chicago. I reached out to them. They actually found me a professor from a local university, DePaul University, connected me with him, and he was vital in my process to help me take these concepts and make them not only validated at the fact that I wasn't making crazy stuff up from the neuroscience research that I was reading, but, you know, taking them down into terms that I could really use into the book. And then, you know, as a part of this, it was really a 13-month writing process. You start seeing things all around you that become stories in your book. Every conversation you have with somebody and you tell them, hey, I'm writing a book, this is what it's about. Almost every single time people would go, oh, you know what? I've got a great example of that. And those are the types of things that end up in the book, are those stories through your process.
Right. So one question I have about this neuroscience part is that, you know, in some of the books, I don't exactly recall the name, but I think some of the books by Daniel Pink talks of a contrarian view that we are actually extremely susceptible to influence. Right. And our subconscious is not as rational at all. I mean, it's more irrational than rational. Where does this cross actually in what you found? And I'm sure you're familiar with his work.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know, I think the way to take it from a sales perspective is to think about this idea that and it was actually came from it was a quote of Antonio Damasio, who's another researcher. He wrote a really interesting book in the late 90s called Descartes' Error. It gets pretty nerdy, but it's super interesting stuff. And it talks about this idea that we as human beings are not thinking machines that feel. We're feeling machines that think.
Correct.
And what that means is, yeah, we make all of our decisions in the feeling and emotion center in our brain and only use the logic to back it up. And that was another big aha moment for me that you'll see throughout the book. is this idea that, you know, I've been teaching my sales reps to lead with logic and ROI and features and benefits. That's very logical. When we lead with stories and emotions and, you know, think about letting a customer see themselves in your stories, that's how you really drive a smooth path to decision making. And so, yeah, Pink stuff is a great foundation for a lot of that. I love his stuff, but it is this concept that we as human beings, when you throw a logo slide up on your presentations, logo slides are actually polarizing to an audience. Because if you've got 10 people you're selling to, 5 might look at those logos and say, wow, if they're good enough for those companies, they must be good enough for us. But the other 5 might be looking at it saying, wow, we're going to be a small fish in a big pond. Or, gosh, those logos don't look like they're in our vertical. Do they really understand our organization? And so, you know, like, logic is extremely polarizing. And that's where a lot of Pink stuff comes from, is how do you actually tag, you know, touch that feeling and emotion center first? And transparency has a magical way of doing that from a trust perspective.
So that has a follow-up question as far as I'm concerned, is that I can understand the role of emotion in the decision-making in the B2C scenario, right?
Yeah.
In the B2B space, you'd imagine that organization, because of multiple stakeholders, it would be driven by logic. What is your experience there?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's why, if you think back 20, 30 years ago, you know, business used to happen on golf courses and at ball games. And because buyers, you know, without knowing the neuroscience around it, knew that, or, I'm sorry, sellers knew without knowing the neuroscience that buyers are attracted to the feeling and emotion associated with making a purchase, right? And so these companies over the last 20 years have instilled these rigid RFP processes, these rigid policies around, hey, like Walmart, for example. Walmart was a company we were calling on at Power Reviews that we couldn't even buy them coffee. We couldn't bring them a little, you know, a sticker that you put on your laptop that has the Power Reviews logo on it. I mean, they were that strict around it because they realized that we need to try to take as much feeling and emotion out of the process as we can and base all of our decisions on logic. Well, the way the brain works, that certainly helps, because now you've got this this feeling, or I guess kind of this policy that you've got to have a strong justification for the purchases that you're making. You've got to do the research and be able to prove to us that your logic makes sense. But as buyers, we're still making buying decisions based on feeling and emotion. One of the things that I taught one company to do, and they're having great results with it, is even in an RFP response, you know, when you get a request for proposal that's got, you know, pages of, does your product do this? How? Does it do this? Does it plug into this? Instead of just saying yes or no, and maybe giving the corporate line around the answers to those, add a column that injects a little personality. Add a column that says, yeah, we do this, but here's how we do it and here's how we view it. And, you know, another one like, hey, this is what this means. And actually add a human component to your RFP responses. And you'd be amazed at what that does to the buyers when they're actually having to read these things. It stands out in a big way. And again, it's just a testament to how we make decisions.
Another interesting point that is coming to mind is that lot of the new companies, especially the tech companies, they actually talk about data-driven decisions, right?
Yeah.
So we decide on analytics, we decide on data, we don't decide on even judgments or gut feels of managers. We look at data and we'll take a call. How does this fit in there?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think that, you know, in many cases, and you know this, we can make data tell whatever story we want it to tell. I think data informs where we focus and what kinds of things we need to make decisions on. But in the end, the decisions are still being made based on a feeling. And so for 1 minute here, let me kind of take you through what those feelings are. Because when we say feelings, we think like, oh, is it love? Is it hate? Is it, you know, no. Right. There's actually a framework for the feelings that drive decisions. And I totally stole this from a guy named Dr. David Rock, who's a neuroscientist. But he came up with this acronym called SCARF.
Okay.
And SCARF, the SCARF are the five different things that drive our decisions. And the S is status, like we buy things to get recognized, to get validated, to get feedback. So, you know, how other people perceive us. The C is certainty. So we buy things when we feel like we can predict what our experience is going to be like.
Right.
That's why we look at reviews and look at the negative reviews first, because we're trying to predict what could go wrong. The A in SCARF is autonomy, meaning we want things that allow us to maintain or gain control. Mm-hmm. We don't want to buy things that make us lose control over our processes, our lives. You know, it's why, you know, a lot of times we'll make a decision to leave a company as an employee because we're being micromanaged. We want the freedom to do what we want to do and the autonomy. The R is relatedness, which is we want to be a part of something. We want to be, you know, doing something for the good of the world, and or we want to be a part of a team or a pack. You know, there's a societal element to it. Mm. And then the F is fairness, meaning is the effort. In terms of resources and dollars and what I'm going to put into it, what I get out of it going to be equal or better. And so those are the five that the SCARF model, when I came across it, it's only like a half a page in the book. But ever since the book came out, I've realized that that SCARF model really should be a beacon for many people to think about, all right, how do I optimize for those things in my positioning, my presenting, my prospecting, to help buyers make better and faster feeling type decisions.
Great, great. So what next? Is it a new book? Is it a bunch of workshops? Is it consultancy? Where is this book leading you now?
Well, yeah, so it was funny. And for everybody that's listening that's thinking about writing a book, here's what happens. You get the idea, you write the book comes out, your friends buy it over the first couple of months. You get a nice little spike at the beginning, and your friends will tell you how great the book is, but they're supposed to tell you that because they're your friends. And then there's a little lull. And then for me, apparently the book is good, because every month since that fourth month, book sales have been going up. So there's kind of a viral component of people that I don't even know that are buying it, reading it, talking about it. And, you know, when they have new hires, that's the book that they read, right? So that has been incredible. And so over that period of time, I have been doing a lot of speaking. So I'm speaking at my last event here of the year coming up this afternoon. But it's been crazy, just all over the place. And then I do workshops around how you present, prospect, position transparently. And then I spend a lot of time teaching transparent negotiating. There is a second book that I'm working on right now, and it's about taking these concepts and applying it to how to maximize the engagement of your sales teams. And it's really focused on transparent leadership. And there's a ton of brain science around how we drive engagement and motivation in salespeople that's yet to make its way into the sales community. And that's what I'm working on right now. So hopefully in mid-late 2020, if I can get the wheels going on this really, really quickly here, that will be a book number two.
Wonderful. And I'm sure you will be back on Bits About Books, maybe this time before the book is out.
I'd love to. That would be great.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Well, Todd, it was a pleasure having you on the show. It was wonderful speaking with you, and I wish you all success and have a great 2020.
Well, thank you. And you too, and to the audience too. I hope 2020 is fantastic, and hopefully a couple of the things that popped out from this will help.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up in the next episode with Tyler Menke is a playful approach to this super serious business of sales in our discussion on his new book, The Pirate's Guide to Sales.
I always think it's funny what stats do. You know, stats can mean one thing on the surface and something entirely different once you dig into it. So one thing that I've seen thrown around a lot is that 60% of salespeople fail to meet their quota. Well, if you think about it and you do the math, everybody's going after the same pool of customers. And let's say you always have three other people vying for the same bid and to acquire the same new customer. Two out of the three are going to lose every time. And it's likely the same guy more frequently than not that actually wins the sale. And that's the guy who does all the legwork. So I think everything's changing exponentially faster. And then in addition, everything's getting bigger, which means we need to be much more focused in our targeting patterns and trying to find customers, not only that we're certain or believe that we can bring value to, but they're actually willing to receive value or make some sort of change.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of weeks with great conversations with Justin Roffmarsh, Brant Pindvik, and Amos Schwartzfarv. Stay tuned. Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.